recovering from spiritual and emotional abuse and addiction to food and work and control. I've had issues with pornography and alcohol and rage and depression and panic. Every now and then, we feel like it's important to revisit the 12 steps and to gain some fresh and new insights on them. Except this time when we go through them, we're not going to do 12 sessions, we're going to do 8, because 3 of the 12 steps are kind of repeats. We intended to do something and then we did it, so we're going to put those together and it'll consolidate a little time. And so January and February, that's what we're going to do. Be doing for 8 lessons, is be talking about the 12 steps, but in 8 lessons. Just as a reminder, several things, just housekeeping things that you may not know. The lessons that we do, the open mics we don't, and the testimonies 50-50, but the lessons we do, we always podcast. So if you want to listen again, or if you want to tell somebody to listen, whatever, it's on the Broadway website. And usually if you want to go to find that, there'll be Melrose, Greenwood, and Pathways, the way they're put on there. Is it still that way? I think so. So, and if you want to hear the Melrose Sunday morning sermons, you can click on that. If you want to hear the Greenwood Sunday morning service, hear Brother Wayne preach. Good stuff. You can listen to him. Do what? Okay, there you go. And then we have Pathway. You can listen to Pathway. So you can recommend it, you know, whatever. And just a reminder that that's available. So, I'm in process just like everybody else is in process. And I don't know any more than anybody else, and I'm not an expert on anything except screwing up. I'm pretty good at that. But so a lot of what I share is what I've gathered from you and what I've gathered from my reading. And over Christmas break, I've done a lot of reading. If you've got your smartphones out, if you've got a piece of paper out, I'll recommend some really good books if you're interested. If you're not, just don't worry about it. But the first one I read was Braving the Wilderness by Brené Brown. Exceptional, exceptional book about knowing yourself, finding out who you are, and living fully into who you are. You can't ever belong to anybody else or any group of people until you know who you are. And this book is really, this lady has impacted my life in an enormous way. I've read several of her books, and this is the latest one, Braving the Wilderness. Then the second book that I read was by, what's his first name? Greg Boyle. He's a priest out in L.A. who works in the hood with gang bangers. He works with homies and homegirls is what he calls them. And he has a ministry that he calls Homeboy Ministries out there. I don't know if anybody's heard of that. But I read a book by him called Barking to the Choir, or Barking at the Choir, which is a combination of barking up the wrong tree and preaching to the choir. So he put the two together, and it's Barking to the Choir, or Barking at the Choir. I forget which one it is. Extremely helpful book in terms of, okay, now that I know who I am, how do I share that with other people? And he gives it in just practical ways that he deals with gang members, a lot of whom work in Homeboy Ministries who have been in rival gangs. They literally have shot bullets at each other, and now they're working arm in arm in Homeboy Ministries. And then the one that I'm reading right now is by Richard Rohr, and it's called The Divine Dance. And I'm telling you, this is the most life-changing book I have probably read in 10 to 15 years. This is an exceptionally good book. And so a lot of what I've read, and especially that book, is going to come out in these lessons. So let's just talk about this. I reworded the first, The Divine Dance by Richard Rohr. Just for fun, because you know how when you say the same thing over and over and over again, sometimes you don't think about it? So just for fun, I reworded step one a little bit. Is that okay? Is anybody going to shoot me or throw anything at me? I just reworded it just so we can say, that's not right. Yeah, but you remembered it, didn't you? Because I'm going to restate it just a little bit. We admitted we were powerless to improve our unmanageable lives. I just shortened it down a little bit. We admitted we were powerless to improve our unmanageable lives. Now, I want to talk about this tonight in terms of how this fits in with grace, because we just finished a big, long session on grace. I forget, did we have 5 or 6 sessions on grace? If you missed those, you can listen to those on the podcast. But we talked about grace, and one of the most earth-shaking discoveries that we made in that series of lessons that has completely changed the way I look at things is that grace, do you remember this? Grace is not a commodity that God hands out, like Halloween treats or something like that. That grace is God's full-on presence with us. It's God fully invested in me, God fully with me, God fully all up in my business, you know, which means that when I show grace to somebody else, it's not a commodity that I give them, it's me fully invested in them. Whatever moment I have with them, it's me fully invested. So through this reading I've done, that definition has gotten fatter. It's gotten a little bit bigger to me. And so we talked about it a little bit in the gathering this morning. Grace is the mutual investment and vulnerability with others in the dance of life. To have this grace and this love and this energy, positive healing energy between two people, whether it's God and us or us and somebody else, to have this, I have to be willing to be vulnerable. In other words, I have to be willing to take from you and receive, which opens me up. And I also have to be willing to invest. So it's an elastic type thing. You get what I'm saying? For grace to happen between you and me, I push into you, I invest into you, and you push into me, invest into me. And if you're on the giving end, you're investing. If you're on the receiving end, you're vulnerable. You're receiving. Does everybody kind of get the picture of that? We have the feeling, religion has taught us wrongly, that we're the grace people that go share with people who are graceless. Everybody has grace in them. Everybody has love and goodness in them. And when we go with them and we encounter them, we are not taking God to them. We are going and encountering God between the two of us, and we're encountering grace and love between the two of us. So it's elastic, back and forth. I'm giving, I'm receiving. You have to surrender to that process or it doesn't work. As long as you go thinking, I've got this. I'm going to change that person. I'm going to fix that person. I'm going to correct that person. I'm going to fine-tune that person. It's not going to work. You're going in there with arrogance and a feeling of condescension and a feeling of knowing everything. When you go into it surrendering to this process, that there's going to be investment and there's going to be vulnerability. And that's when the grace is going to happen. And that's when in between us is where the miracles and the magic's going to happen. So therefore, grace is never a noun. Grace is always a verb. Grace is that energy, that palpable energy between two people when they encounter each other with vulnerability and investment. You have to have those two, and you have to have two people who surrender to that and trust the other person in that. What's that got to do with step one? In all the reading that I've done, the one common thing that they say gets people in trouble, Brené Brown, Gregory Boyle, Richard Rohr, the one thing they say gets everybody in trouble is when we say, I can do this on my own. I don't need anybody else. I can live life, I can solve my own problems on my own. I don't need grace. All I need is me and my ingenuity. So forget everybody else. If you think about an atom, and you've got a proton and a neutron and an electron, in order for that atom to be viable and for that atom to be an actual energy atom, all the parts in it have to interact with all the other parts. If all of a sudden you have this rogue proton or electron who say, you know, I'm not really interested in this dance anymore. I'm going to go out and do my own thing. The atom goes dead. There is no more energy in that atom. All the parties have to cooperate and interact with each other. That's what brings the power and the grace, and that's what brings That's what brings change. That's what produces. What gets us in trouble? All these books that I've read said that the primary theme that runs through everything with addicts and alcoholics and gang members and rapists and serial killers, the one thing that runs through all of them, people who are mentally ill, I mean, I remember seeing it over and over in three different authors, that the one common thread is loneliness, isolation. That's the one thing that is common to every single one of them. These are all people who are saying, I can do this on my own. And so the first step is to say, you know what? No, I can't. No, I can't. And I don't know about you, but that was my step back to sanity. That was my first step back to sanity when I said, I cannot do this on my own. I studied hard. I got degrees. I had years of experience. I had, and none of that helped. None of that helped. I finally had to just say, I can't do this. You see, it's this disconnect with other people and it's this disconnect with God that is killing us. It's not the alcohol. It's not the drugs. It's not the violence. It's not the pornography. It's not whatever, anything else you want to say. Whatever the issue is, that's not what's killing us. What's killing us is this feeling that we're all alone. Or this feeling that I just want to do this on my own. Some of us are lonely by choice, and some of us are lonely because we don't see that there's any other option. That we see that's our only option. But the common thread that runs through mental illness, through emotional pain, through addiction, through codependency, through all of this, the common thread that you can identify in every single place is this isolation, this loneliness. We were not meant to live outside the atom. I don't know whether you're an electron, a proton, or a neutron, but you were meant to live inside the atom in relationship with the other two. That's how we were designed to live. The whole universe functions this way. This is the law of science that rules everything, that we live in connection with other people. Now, connection doesn't, some people say, well, I cohabitate with so-and-so, or I work with people, or I'm in a relationship. It's not the best. It's abusive, and I use them, and they use me, and so we're kind of connected. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a mutual relationship where I enter into it to invest myself and to be vulnerable and trusting the other person to do the same. That's what I'm talking about. That when, if we don't have that in our lives, we're dying. And it's not alcohol and drugs and porn and the rest that's the problem. It's this disassociation with other people. We're not in that relationship. And when that happens, like in an atom, when that happens, the atom just paralyzes. It freezes. It's stuck. It's static. It's, you know, it just doesn't work anymore as an atom. And you think, this may be a terrible analogy, but you think about somebody in prison. And you say, not only are we going to put you in prison, we are going to put you in solitary. I mean, the world over, the worst thing besides death is solitary. We're going to make you be by yourself. And none of us sign up for solitary. None of us one day in our youth say, okay, from here on out, I want to be in solitary confinement. From here on out. It just happens. It becomes the safest alternative. And few of us, very few of us, could ever say, and I know the day that happened. Could we? I don't know when I picked isolation, but I know somewhere along the line, I did. I picked it as my lifestyle, and that's when I started to die. That's when everything started to just, you know. And when you think about, let's push that analogy just a little further. You think about waking up in solitary confinement in prison. You think about waking up in solitary day after day after day after day. Why even wake up? Where is your hope? Today's going to be better. How? You know, you're in total and absolute isolation. You're left to yourself. You know? And yet, in our addictions, in our compulsive behaviors, in our unmanageable lives, we find ourselves in solitary confinement. What is one of the first things you realized when you got in recovery? One of the first things I realized when I started to open up is, you mean, I'm not the only one who deals with this issue? Do you remember that aha moment? When you got in and you started to tell your story, and other people started to share their stories, and you thought, they're just like me. And yet this whole time you thought you were the only one in the world who lived in that solitary cell. I'm the only one who deals with this issue. And yet when you get into recovery, you realize, wow, you too? So I think the step one, a huge part of this step one is admitting you're powerless, is to realize the absolute deadly futility of trying to do this on your own. We were not meant to figure this out on our own. It doesn't work. Life shrinks, hope goes, darkness comes in, light goes out. You know, it goes from existing to just barely surviving. That's just no fun. No fun. And I think this is when I got in recovery, is when, you know, the story Jesus told about the prodigal son, and he came to his senses. He had this aha moment. And I think any of us who've been in recovery for any length of time have had this aha moment. There is an alternative. There is something other than solitary confinement. There is something other than trying to fix this on my own. And we reach out to other people. And this happens, I think this happens two different ways. And I don't know that it's important to say it, but I think it's important to say it in a way that we understand there's not just one way it happens. Let's put it that way. Our aha moment sometimes comes kind of like the prodigal son said. He came to his senses. He had this reasonable moment. He was factoring things in his head. He was thinking things through. He was considering. He was calculating. And when he did the math, it just made sense to go home. Reasonable thinking. But there's the other side of this, which is just this desperation of inner death. We're dying on the inside, and we get desperate just to, where's the next breath going to come from? Where's the next, you know, I'm just desperate. And that's not so much reasonable, it's just desperation. Well, actually, the guy in the prodigal son, he probably was both. He was desperate and he was reasonable. But some of you came into recovery because you kind of factored it out in your mind. I really have no other alternatives. There wasn't a whole lot of passion involved. There wasn't a lot of bleeding out. You didn't come in here just weeping out, you know. You came because it made sense to come. That's a good reason to be here. Other people came because you ran out of fingernails. You were just hanging on and your fingernails just eventually rubbed off. You ran out of fingernails and couldn't hang on. And you said, I don't know if this will work. It doesn't make any sense to me, but I'm throwing myself in there and see what happens. So you may have come, one of those two extremes or somewhere in the middle, but we're here. We're here. And we're admitting that we're powerless to improve our unmanageable lives. And we're saying, I no longer want to live this kind of life anymore. That's why we get a desire token. We come up and get a desire token. It's not magic. It doesn't change anything to get it, but it's symbolic to some of us. I'm not a token person. When's the last time you saw me get a token? It's just not my thing. And I've had several of you say it's not my thing, but other people, it's really important. That's why we do it. But that's the reason, because it's symbolic of, I want to make a change. I don't know who sang this song. Who sang that song, I Want to Dance with Somebody, I Want to Feel the Heat with Somebody? Who? Okay. And I don't know what she meant by that song, but you know what? When I think of that now, I want to dance with somebody. There's no sexual connotation to that or any sensual. It's like, no, I want to dance with somebody. And here's the thing that hit me this week. Religion told me that if I came up to get a desire token or came to the altar, remember those altar services where they pled for you to come down front and, you know, come and repent and all this. I remember the feelings that I had. I always had this feeling of dread. I had a feeling, I don't know what I'm signing up for, but it's not going to be good. I'm going to take a whooping over this somehow. And it was almost like I was signing up for a tour of duty, but not a, it was more like I was drafted than I was signing up for it. And in recovery and in Pathway, no, when you come and get a token or when you want to make a change, you're not signing up for a tour of duty. You're signing up for a dance partner. That is so totally different. You're signing up for a dance. And that dance just gets more wild and free and extravagant and liberating and life-giving with every step. Think about that, that what we have with God, think about that, what we have with God and what we have with each other is not a tour of duty. It is a dance. Let that sink in. Dad, I want to come home and work for you. Would you hire me on? And Dad says, are you crazy? Let's go have a party and dance. That's what I want to do with you. Well, when we get to step two, which will be a combination of two and three, when we get to that next week, then we're going to start talking about, okay, so what does it look like to be in this dance? What does that look like to have a dance partner? Where does it go when you have a dance partner? Because if you have a, remember what we were saying, if you have a relationship with somebody that's meaningful, there's investment and there's vulnerability. Okay, so if I'm going to dance with God, I invest myself in the dance and I'm vulnerable in that dance. Or if I choose to do that with a recovery partner, I'm vulnerable with that recovery partner and I invest myself. What does that dance look like? How does that flesh out? Because it's not some principle on paper. It's a radical shift, a practical radical shift in the way we deal with each other. It's not your normal relationship. It's a different kind of relationship. So we'll talk about that next week. But just, I want to, remember we said, I just want to review this as we end tonight. Grace is not a commodity God doles out to us like Halloween treats. We've been over that and over that and over that. Grace is God giving himself to us. What does that look like? Grace is mutual investment and vulnerability with others in the dance of life. Those two words to me are so crucial. Investment and vulnerability. Investment and vulnerability. And therefore, grace is never a noun. It's always a verb. Always, always. We're going to do one more song.